Meanwhile, to the flesh, since after Peter Holland went west, the Institute directorship passed to Russell Jackson. And since we're getting towards the panto season, it was seemed a shame not to hear from... oh, yes, we are. it seemed a shame not to hear from Russell, the Allardyce Nicol Chair of Drama, the Chair of the Drama Department at the University of Birmingham, you know, one of our great living theatre historians and theatre people, to speak with technological assistance, first time in captivity, folks, about the relations between the Institute and the theatre.
I'm going to use this mic and talk loud. And this will do what I need it to do. So that says what it says. And that shows something else. There we are. Technology is wonderful. I'd just like to establish my credentials in terms of what my distinguished predecessors have been talking about. I was supervised by Stanley Wells and led into the areas of theatre history by him in a rigorous way. I was examined for my PhD by Allardyce Nicol. Unfortunately, I never met Allardyce. And as I've said on a number of other occasions, soon after reading my thesis, Allardyce was no longer with us. But don't know, post hoc ergo propter hoc. However, I benefited greatly from his advice on the thesis, and I benefited enormously from the Institute and its atmosphere, which has been evoked so... its sense of community, which Peter's evoked. So I'm going to take a step back, and I'm going to be talking very briefly, because it's nearly lunchtime, about the Institute and the theatre. And really it's a tale of a number of theatres. They keep accumulating. There's one actually, there's two down the road not being currently used, I think. The one that's the kind of the series of storage containers and the one next door that used to be the other place. And the future will take us in interesting directions. But let's go back even before the Institute was thought of, but actually to a time when the Institute was thought of, because when the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre, here in a postcard from the 1900s, was established, among the proposals was that there should be an academy and there should be either a training school for actors or some kind of study centre. And amongst all the argy-bargy about this, including a lot of people in London particularly saying this would be a waste of time, why should we build a theatre for the benefit of the tradesmen of Stratford, was one of the arguments used, especially by some people in Birmingham, then in fact that went by the wayside a little. But it was something that was there germinally, if you like, in the idea of Stratford as a study centre for Shakespeare and a performance centre for Shakespeare. If we go to the 1932 building, and there'll be more of this in a few minutes, the 1932 building, seen here in its pristine state, I think that's the pristine state, on another postcard, hence the rather fuzzy image, the 1932 building wasn't built with that particular intention in mind, but it's a building that is worth keeping in mind because it's no longer there. And it was decorated in what can only be described as the state-of-the-art Art Deco ocean liner style. In fact, I've often used a leaflet from the maiden voyage of the Queen Elizabeth liner to demonstrate the similarity in woodwork between and interior decoration between the old SMT, this SMT, and ocean liners of the 30s. It showed, particularly down to details like the marquetry and steel I think they were steel, Susan Brock will correct me if I'm wrong, steel, metal of some kind, decorations, inlays on the doors that entered and exited the auditorium. Now, this isn't here just for nostalgia, but it's also... well, it is, actually, so the hell with that. Okay. So, post-war bridge building, that's already been mentioned by Reg and by John, except, I have to say, Germany for the time being. Initially. The information here comes from my study of Stratford-on-Avon-Sean, 1 shilling, quite a lot of money actually, September 1946, which is the source of the following illustrations. That's the cover. And this is about Shakespeare Institute and actors. And here we have a dialogue. Ariel meets John Dover Wilson. At a British council, Shakespeare conference that was held in 1946 as the beginnings of the bridge building process, which Allardyce and the Institute carried forward so fully. The caption for this is that the young schoolboy, whose name I forget for the moment, who was playing Ariel in the production of The Tempest, one of the first productions in the first post-war season, is here seen sharing a joke with John Dover Wilson. I invite you to imagine the dialogue. I think John Dover Wilson is saying, and I apologise, I never knew him, so I don't know what his voice was like, but I imagine him as saying, "I say, young fellow, do you think we could share a joke?" And Ariel is saying, "Oh, yes, sir, I think it's a good idea, especially in this period of austerity, when to have a joke on one's own would be a mistake. Shall I start?" "Yes, do, young fellow." I say, what happens in Hamlet?" To which the answer is, "Less of your lip, young fellow, or you'll lose your sweet ration," which we will remember carried on for quite a few years after this. But there was dialogue, and one of the things that happened at that conference was the bringing together of continental, as they're described in this, which suggests a kind of naughtiness that may not have been present, continental experts, and there's Allardyce chairing a meeting, I think directly in front of that door over there. That's where they are, in this room. And he's chairing a meeting. They're lined up opposite each other like members of the International Monetary Fund and the European Union across a table. And this was one of the private sessions. There were public lectures, including lectures by different European Shakespeareans. One of them chaired, there's a wonderful picture of E.M.W. Tilliard chairing. On this platform, it has not changed much. It still creaks the way it used to. You can't hear it now. It doesn't, no. It's been fixed. That bit does. But facing chairs that were so penitential that some of us still remember them and bear the marks of them for a long time. But this also included dialogue with actors. The dialogue with actors at this 1946 conference consisted of the actors coming to the lunch at the conference, which is a pretty good way of dialoguing with anybody. And as friends who are actors will say, actors never refuse sandwiches. Right, basic rule. I think it's part first year at RADA, sandwiches, you know, first term, first week. Anyway, but bringing actors and academics together. But one has to remember that there's a different social makeup within the theatre, a sense of a certain difference in the theatre in the post-war years. And that sense of there being lectures and discussions of a friendly kind, but participatory activity was rather more remote. I've included this simply as an illustration. This is a 1951 Ronald Searle Punch cartoon representing Richard II, with Michael Redgrave on the left-hand side as Richard. It's Harry Andrews, I think, in the fork. No, Hugh Griffiths? Harry Andrews. Hugh Griffiths, thank you. And who's in the middle? Anyway, we'll get back to this. This is your starter for 10, Stanley. But also, these are years of extraordinary performances, particularly the Oliviers in. And this is the Oliviers in Titus Andronicus. And it's an interesting symbol, not only of a great, great performance, and a very influential performance by one of the greatest actors ever, but also of a way the theatre was thought about and the way it had to think about itself in presenting itself to the public as a star system theatre. That's what people are paying for, that's what they're coming, with other things, yes, around it. So that's not to denigrate what went on in that theatre in those years, but to remind ourselves that this is the way the theatre had to present itself. The gap between that and the way the theatre presents itself now is different. Perhaps it's subtler than we think it is, if you can have a subtle gap, but it's an interesting difference. It is also, by the way, an iconic piece of theatre photography of a particular kind, which we won't go into now because this is not a lecture, this is... well, whatever it is. And just to remind ourselves of this, those were the days. A programme advertisement for Olivier tipped cigarettes that had been blended specially for Laurence Olivier and endorsed by him, and were 10 for 1 and 8p. I'll leave the translation of the money to you, but it's about less than 10p in modern money. But of course, by then 1 and 8p, you could have bought a stall sheet at seat at the RSC and had the hotel room and a steak and chips and the tram ride home, couldn't you? A difference in style that you get is by looking at these two things, I think. Just to hold up Exhibit A, This is a souvenir book for the 1959 season, the 100th season. One thing about Stratford is that we keep celebrating our nth anniversaries. I think I've celebrated the Institute's nth anniversary three times already, if you include Stanley's birthday, which in itself is a major event. So this is that, and that's in a way that's a souvenir book from the 1959 season, and it represents. I've used it crudely to represent a distance in style. The size is not significant. This happens to be the little one. From the RSC 111th Shakespeare season, booking period 2 in 1970. And it's just interesting when one starts looking at the typography, the presentation of itself at the theatre. We moved on. There's intermediate stages, of course, for after 1960, after the founding of the Royal Shakespeare Company as such. But this is the booking period that includes, by the way, the first appearance of Peter Brook's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. But to go back a little bit... We're moving into the Wars of the Roses in 1963, or what some people may think this looks like a Thursday seminar at the Shakespeare Institute. And we're moving into a period of engagement with the theatre that's marked by major publications and activity within the Institute and by members of the Institute, including particularly Stanley Wells. Stanley's influence on the theatre, of course, has been enormous, not quite such as was suggested by Mr. Shapiro once when he asked me in the Common Room in Birmingham, "Have you seen the production of Hamlet at Stratford?" "No, I haven't, Ship." "Well, I think it's a travesty." "Have you seen it, Ship?" "No, but all the press says it's a travesty." "Oh, really? Can't Wells do something about this?" And, of course, it's the period of... And I put this in because it's my first big Shakespeare production, the first one I saw, David Warner as Hamlet, with Glenda Jackson? Glenda Jackson, who has since moved on to higher things as Ophelia. That's the first time round for the Hamlet production, which Stanley wrote about in a very influential way, which I have to be personal and say convinced me that that's the way I'd like to be able to write about production. So stick around, it may happen yet, you know. More walking down memory lane, especially in two ways. This is Judy Dench in Winter's Tale in 1969. This is an EP, an extended play record of Guy Wolfenden's music. 33.5 revolutions per minute, which was also concurrently in more radical theatre and aim anyway, but in other senses. But this is a 33 RPM EP record of Guy Wolfenden's Winter's Tale music. And a picture of Judy there, which is actually the poster design for that production, with "Thou Mets with Things Dying, I with Things Newborn." And the production, which quite wonderfully, she doubled Perdita and Hermione. Never quite to her own satisfaction, I think she said. And here she is, as Perdita. And Brooke's Dream, just to remind ourselves of how little you can do with... how much you can do, anyway. But a great revolutionary production. And something else, too, for those of you who just are in the current world of ID, this swipe card was preceded by this. On decal-edged stationery, signed by Tom Matheson, the deputy director of the Institute, or acting director as he was in 1978, shortly after Terence's death, unfortunately. And it's signed by Tom. And you could be in the Institute's building in Westmere 24 hours a day, and you just had to produce this when the security men came round. And some very interesting characters stayed in the Institute overnight, but we haven't got time for that. So, to the nub of the matter. Bringing theatre workers into the academic arena. I mentioned Stanley's work in this respect. It's also important to think about the contributions by Robert Smallwood, and since then by Paul Edmondson, to go to something... Those are members of the Institute, fellows of the Institute, and also... connections with the Birthplace Trust. Because something you mustn't forget, there are three groups of people involved in this. The Birthplace Trust, the Shakespeare Institute, the Royal Shakespeare Company. But it needs individuals driving it, and it's had them in these people. Maurice Daniels, who if he'd remained in America working would have been known as Maurice Daniels, an extraordinary man of the theatre who was instrumental in pushing forward the Institute's engagement with the RSC, with people from the RSC coming to teach in various ways, and Sonia Desange, company manager for so much of the period when Robert Smallwood was dealing with that aspect of our work, who were coordinating our relationship with the theatre. But it was very largely, and indeed it was almost entirely, on the basis of personal connection and personal diligence and hanging about at the stage door and leaving notes for people, and then leaning out of the window in the room, this is now John Jowett's room, hoping that you would see Fiona Shaw come round the corner at 5 minutes past the hour. But it was a remarkable programme of courses and conferences at the Institute and at the Birthplace Trust, a winter school from the Institute in Edgbaston, when it was there for a while, at Westmere, bringing MA students down here on the pattern of the fact that undergraduates had a week in Stratford in those days being the mid-70s to late 80s, and the International Shakespeare Conference. The participation of actors in different ways, in different kinds of format, if you like, in all these things, was very important. The Thursday seminars included talks by, discussions with actors, talks and classes on Wednesday afternoons, when the university is supposed to allow us to play sports. Ha! The Institute's football team manages without having the whole of Wednesday afternoon for it, I gather. And these included such things as in voice with Sis Berry and Andrew Wade and other great voice teachers, sessions on wigs and makeup, on design, and a rehearsal of scenes. I still bear the scars of a particularly vigorous improvisation session which involved students chasing around the room, supervised by the unholy duo of Fiona Shaw and Juliet Stevenson while trying to recite sonnets. And in fact, I put my hand through one of these windows. It costs so much to repair the window that really we wouldn't do that nowadays. Health and safety, forget it. Sessions at the Shakespeare Centre, which were very important participation on the part of fellows of the Institute and associated members of the Institute and members of the RSC. And the basic pattern being go to the theatre, think about the theatre, talk about the theatre with the people who do it and do it with them and then go and do it on your own. And write about it. Oh, and edit the odd play. Okay. So, in a sense, sometimes this is nothing. This is 42nd Street. But Ruby Keeler is being told to find which foot is the left foot, which she never quite found, by Warner Baxter, Julian Marsh. Anyway, interrogating the actors, asking the actors what they do. Sometimes it has involved a slightly de haut en bas manner, not from anybody here present, but there are one or two occasions I remember, Westmere, for example, when an actor was told exactly what his performance as Troilus actually meant, which was one of those things that's an unanswerable question. You say, oh, yes, okay, good. How interesting. When's tea? But interrogating the actor. But that led, these occasions have led to a number of outputs. I'm largely talking about the era before learning outcomes and performance indicators, which I used to think was something you did in the driving test, one of those old cars. Anyway, but one major output from all this, and there have been many others, was the series Players of Shakespeare, the Cambridge series, inaugurated with this volume edited by Philip Brockbank. The second one was edited by me and Robert Smallwood. Subsequent ones, I did another one with Robert, but mainly by Robert, because Robert was the link with what was going on in the theatre, the person who was having most to do with the actors in the subsequent period of Players of Shakespeare. And this was a pioneering set of volumes, because actors wrote, for the most part, in a couple of cases, interviews were turned into joined-up writing, shall we say, on their behalf. Actors wrote about playing the parts, and this kind of resource is something we're so useful that I think it's worth used to, that I think it's worth remembering. It's one of the things that the Institute was a leading edge in. And part of my point in all this is that it's something the Institute has been historically moving forward in various directions throughout these 60 years. This is just one example of it. Turning all that stuff about actors talking about Shakespeare with students into this kind of publication that, if you like, is what nowadays, in the jargon that we live with, is knowledge transfer. Oops, you thought that was so? So, there were new spaces in the theatre, just to remind ourselves. It was Harriet Walter, who we'll be hearing from later, as Imogen at David Bradley, Nicholas Farrell in Cymbeline at the old other place. Then there's The Swan, Simon Russell Beale, as wonderfully acidulous Thersites. And with apologies to Richard II himself, who is with us, I only had a photograph of Bushy Baggot Green and the Queen from the production in which Sam played the King. A production at the new other place, currently not, you know, in mothballs, shall we say, with wonderfully... And it's interesting, if we had time, and if this was that kind of talk, we'd go back to the 1951 picture and see interesting differences in all sorts of ways. But this, of course, is the production which, apart from the extraordinarily riveting and all that stuff performance of the King himself, was also memorable for Bolingbroke insisting the audience should stand up for a few moments' silence in memory of Thomas, Duke of Mowbray, which produced very strange experience every night. So, an end and a beginning. Because it's nearly lunchtime, in fact it's over lunchtime, so here's the end. But it's also a beginning. I just thought a couple of images of that, and then that. This is for the nostalgia people. Think back to that 1932 photo. Look on his works, you know, and despair, so to speak. And finally, though, this, which may seem to be a rather boring picture of the same thing, but it just shows how theatre history is both transitory and always with us. Along the corridor of the theatre, on the second story, along the waterside side of the theatre, well known to anybody who's worked there, was a whole wall of posters of past productions. Luckily, these are not the only copies of these posters, I hope. But when the demolition was going on, there was a strange experience of seeing this particular bit of what you might call theatre archaeology in reverse going on. As the poster corridor, the RSC's recent past, and they were all from the 80s onwards, is going. I think Rafe Fiennes is there. I'm not going to go on with this. That's enough of that. Thank you very much.